Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. We've talked about Libya several times over the last couple of months, but they remain in front page news. What's happening right now, Jim?
Well, it appears that the French have admitted that they have unleashed the Berbers. I just wrote up a piece earlier today for Strategy Page, and I guess I'll put it out there tomorrow. The French admitted that they have been dropping weapons. They started with humanitarian drops in Misurata, you know, that city not too far from Tripoli that has always been in rebel hands. And then they decided, and they dropped a few weapons. They couldn't get a straight answer from the UN. Surprise, surprise. Quietly started dropping small arms, RPGs, and a lot of ammunition, to rebel groups that asked for it. I'm assuming that, because they also admitted they dropped medical supplies, that they also dropped radios and medical supplies along with the small arms. That apparently they took notes about what happened 10 years ago in Afghanistan, you know, where a few, you know, ill-trained troops on the ground with small arms, supported by planes overhead with smart bombs. If you had radio communication with those people on the ground, and the French aren't admitting that they have air, you know, controllers down there, but in many cases, apparently NATO has learned to do without official air controllers, and simply, you know, if they have radio contact down there and get enough information, the answers apparently worked out quite well. The guys on that other hill, right? Okay, here comes a, you know, 2,000-pound smart bomb. Boom. And that works wonders, even if the enemy is, you know, nearby. And that has enabled them to get the Berbers, where most of the weapons have gone. Apparently they've dropped about 50 tons worth of stuff. They made an official announcement a day or two ago, but just piecing together information from various other sources. They've been dropping quite a lot, and most of it has been going to the Berbers. Now, the Berbers, as we know, if you read Strategy Page, are the original inhabitants. The Berbers and their cousins, their nomadic Tuaregs to the south, who have all, these two groups have long dominated North Africa. They were, the Berbers in particular, were one of the few groups that successfully slowed down the Arab incursion, you know, 7th century, 1400 years ago. And they never really surrendered to the Arabs. They still speak their Berber language. They maintain their Berber culture, which, by the way, is matrilineal. The Arabs must have loved that. You know, inheritance is through the female line. And indeed, one of the most successful generals resisting the Arab invasion was the Kahina, a female tribal leader, which again, with matrilineal descent, you know, makes sense. They had a lot of females, you know, running the tribes. And the French got most of their resistance from the Berbers during the colonial period in the 19th century, from the Berbers and the Tuaregs. So it's no surprise that, A, Gaddafi has hired Tuareg mercenaries, as many as he could get, and the Berbers who live in the mountains south of Tripoli, throughout North Africa, the mountains south of the coastal plains, have been getting most of those weapons and radios and air support. You know, again, piecing together from various reports, I've only got one connection inside Libya, at least he says he's from inside Libya. I suspect it might be secondhand. But anyway, he's an Arab. And apparently they've been getting a lot of these weapons. Some of the weapons have been coming from the Gulf states. And apparently there are some foreign people on the ground with the Berbers, apparently operating the radios, you know, with the aircraft. Anyway, they've been blasting their way. They're on the coastal plain now, and they're using the same strategy along the coast road where the other attacks are. The other attack is coming, but apparently the French are betting on the Berbers getting there first, because the French have a history with the Berbers, and the Berbers are apparently proving the French right so far.
Wow. Austin, what have you been noticing happening?
Well, let me point out one thing. I'm going to go to the kind of political level here for a second. I noticed that and this is on the web today as we discuss this, that a couple of rebel spokesmen are claiming that the French are not giving them arms, even though, as Jim just
No, they're giving them to the Berbers. That's the problem. The guys along the coast road are not Berbers.
I was going to point that out. The thing is, though, that nominally they're all still part of that transitional
coalition.
National
yeah,
Council or Libyan National
There are traditional differences which aren't disappearing anytime
soon. Yeah, that's true. The point,
and the Arabs will not be happy. And the Arabs will not be happy if the Berbers get to Tripoli first. You know, it's like the Marines and the Army headed for Baghdad.
Well, there's still the issue, as you brought up, of Misurata, but I'll get to that in just say Misurata's not all that far from Tripoli. The problem with Misurata is that they are isolated, even though Gaddafi has apparently had to pull back his rockets. He's lost a lot of rockets, multiple launch rocket systems and artillery, and lost a bunch of tanks out there. The rebels don't have the strength there at Misurata to make that move along the coast or the west to Tripoli, at least yet. I'm going to talk through something I wrote a couple of weeks ago in my column, which, on point, and I pointed out that, I wrote in the end of April that Gaddafi really was fighting on five different fronts, and I'll just go through them. You can call it Eastern Front, Benghazi, Southern Front, that's what I called where the rebels were. Misurata, which at the time was still under heavy siege, but you had to treat it as a front, and in some ways it was the most critical one at that time. Then what I said, the Western Coastal Sector, which Gaddafi had pretty well suppressed, and that's between Tripoli and the Tunisian border. There are several little towns in there that had uprisings when this was kicking off in late February, early March, but he's got to garrison it. It's you'd call it a sector maybe than a front, but when you're going to write a newspaper column that's not written strictly for the aficionados, you can try to keep it as simple as possible. And the other one was that what's the equivalent of strategic air war, which is NATO bombing Tripoli and really trying to hit, the way it's couched is we're going after command and control facilities, but in a dictatorship, what's the key command and control facility? It's the dictator, which is why you see the reports that on the internet and in some of the mainstream media about the attempts to get Gaddafi, that this is assassination by aerial attack, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. But those were those five fronts that I wrote about in April, and then a couple of weeks ago I said, there's really a sixth emerging, because over the last, since the middle of May, we started getting reports about increasing dissident activity inside Tripoli itself, which is intel, and part of the dissident activity, heck, it's showing up in various digital media that it's coming from people living in Tripoli. There are a few Western reporters inside Tripoli that have talked to these people, and they've even the reporters have seen evidence of dissident activity in the streets. They're not out blowing things up. They're not rebels, but it's anti-Gaddafi regime activity. So he's got to garrison that. Again, that's really more of, if we were looking at it in strictly military terms, a sector, but it's a front, and it's an important political front. So Gaddafi lacks the decisive power to win on any single one of these fronts, Dan. That was the gist of my column a couple of weeks ago, which means, he's fighting six different fires and can't put out any of them, with the possible exception of that sector between Tripoli and the Tunisian border along the coast. But that's still a potential fire. When I'm using a fire as a metaphor, that's the place he's got to have some security forces. So what's now, at the same time, rebel forces have the siege of Misurata lifted for the most part. Jim described some of the tactics that NATO's used in conjunction with the rebels in Misurata. Smart bombs, knock out the blink the tanks, knock out the artillery systems, and then there have been also aid convoys that have sailed into Misurata. The NATO naval forces cleared it out. Libya tried, I mean, Gaddafi tried to do some mining, and you know, they lost what little fleet he had in the area. So Misurata is citizenry is being taken care of in terms of food and medical care. I suspect, no evidence on this, I also suspect there's been some degree of at least ammunition replenishment for the rebels there. That's my suspicion. No evidence. I haven't read anything about it, but they still seem to have plenty of at least AK ammunition and heavy machine gun ammo. Rebels on the other side, as of 2 weeks ago, did not have, at least hadn't showed, any ability to achieve a decisive operation on any of those sectors that I described. Though, let's get back to the Berbers, which I called at the Southern Front. A lot of action there. There were attacks by Gaddafi mercenary forces, specifically on Libyan town, the name's escaping me at the time. It begins with an M, but I know the Tunisian town on the western side of the Libya-Tunisia border. It's you pronounce it like Djiba, in part because that's where the Turks in 1911 used Djiba as a supply point for Ottoman forces and predominantly Berber, well, not solely, but Berber and Arab tribal forces that were resisting the Italians in the Turco-Italian War of 1911-1912. That's where supplies and all well greased in terms of bribes and set up with the French, since the French controlled Tunisia, in 1911. But that was a line of communication for the Turkish forces that were operating in the interior and away from the coast, because the Italian Navy had all the firepower advantages. You got closer to the coast. Gaddafi's forces know, whether they know that history or not, they can just look at the map and they know what the Berbers are at least, and this has been documented. There's a couple of very good BBC reports on this, but there's also evidence coming out of the Libyan rebels, the Transitional National Council, about the Berbers getting medical, non-lethal aid through that corridor, and which is one reason that the Berbers have fought so fiercely to keep it open. I saw, again, this about 2 weeks ago, on the web, an appeal from a Berber leader for arms. It was particularly one of the things they were after. They wanted some heavier weapons with some anti-tank capability. And again, referring to what Jim said when he was discussing the Berber operations, is that it looks like they have been getting those by weapons drops, airdrops, from the French. So the point being, Dan, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen indications that at least out of the south, and I'm just using this as a reinforced Jim's point, that the Berbers have been reinforced. They certainly have the how to put this? They're well organized fighters, and they're a threat to march north to Tripoli. I'm not in position to make a prediction of when and how this is going to happen, but I think we're looking at something that will, in the next few weeks, that southern sector, you may well see a rebel offensive. Now let me put this in some other operational terms. I don't know what the capabilities are in Misurata, other than what I outlined. I don't know what the situation is on that eastern front, you know, the so-called Benghazi front, but it basically cuts through Brega right now. Mersa Brega, for those of you who are old World War II Africa Corps aficionados. It seems to be in that zone there. If the rebels could coordinate attacks in all of those sectors, and in some ways, an uprising in that western sector between Tripoli, some action, rebel action. I don't mean just dissident action, but blow up a few vehicles in order to distract them. Gaddafi, his regime would be put under an extraordinary military stress. I don't know if they've got those capabilities, but you see the little plan I'm outlining? The capacities, what's on the map right now? What's on the map? That kind of coordinated action is very hard to pull off. Would really put the Gaddafi's forces in a really stress them and stretch them. Now Jim points out that the Arabs don't want the Berbers to make the advance, but I'll tell you what: if somebody knocks him out, all the rebel factions are going to benefit. So,
but what the Berbers are
ethnic divide.
You know, what the Berbers are looking for is the same thing they're looking for in Algeria, is autonomy and recognition of their cultural, you know, uniqueness.
Sure. This is something we'll go at the end. Yeah.
Exactly, and this is something the Arab conquerors, as the Berbers call them, have never been willing to grant. So this is liable to get interesting. I mean, much has been made ever since the unrest, the civil war began in Libya, about the tribal differences, but the big divide is really ethnic. The Berbers have been a thorn in the side of the Arab rulers of North Africa for over 1,000 years.
Well, they were a thorn in the side of the Roman rulers too.
The Numidian troops that formed the core of Hannibal's army that ravaged Italy for years during the First Punic War were basically Berbers.
For a long time and done some really have had some really classic military experience too.
Yes, but they've always been subject to some bunch of bigger bullies coming in from the sea. I mean, first it was the Phoenicians, and then the Turks, well then the Arabs, then the Turks, then the French. I mean, you're getting kind of tired of this, but God, you got to give them credit for persistence. And I think they see this as their time, as it were. So the next big imbroglio, I think, in Libya is going to be the Berbers. And we've been reporting about the situation in Algeria, which is still on simmer. I mean, that's liable to explode, before the end of the year. But again, it's propelled in part, by the Berbers. The biggest troublemakers, as far as the Arabs are concerned, have always been the Berbers. So the Berbers want it, I think, more than the Arabs do. They want, independence. They're willing to do it within a state, framework. They've made that clear. There's never been a big agitation for a Berber stand or whatever, because they're not concentrated enough. They're a minority throughout, North Africa. And of course, the Egyptians are, according to the archaeologists and language experts and whatnot, they're basically, cousins of they're basically the Egyptians who went feral. And some of the ancient Berbers, stumbled upon the Nile and said, hey, this thing floods every year. We could make something out of this. And bing, there you get the Egyptians. But the rest of them who stayed out, actually, another interesting point is that in antiquity, 2,000 or more years ago, the arable part of North Africa extended 100 miles further south. In other words, they talk about climate change. There's been enormous climate change, which there's a historical record for. There's thousands of years of records, that have survived, complaining about how it's getting drier and drier along the North African coast. And this is something that that has basically affected the Berbers, because basically they got these foreign invaders coming from the north, and they got this damn dry weather coming from the south. So North Africa owes a lot to the Berbers, and the Berbers want to get paid this time around.
Well, look, just to put some background to this discussion, I think it was the second edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, which came out in 1991. If not, mm-hmm. it's the third, but where we had an appendix on the Berber question in North Africa.
Yeah.
It's not news. What is news is this, is that Gaddafi's regime gives them an opportunity, and one that they have enough educated, media-savvy people to take advantage of, to after the fall of Gaddafi, then looking beyond the fall of his regime, if and when it comes. I do think it's going to come, but you know, we don't know the future, to achieve some of their demands for cultural recognition. Jim mentioned that, some degree of political autonomy, and that's what they want. And
what we're going to see is another, you know, ugly example of the Arab disease, where they're just going to dig in. They're not going to want to make any concessions. I mean, we see it playing out, you know, in Iraq right now, where two factions of the Shia majority are not talking to each other, and basically the government is paralyzed. And another, the non-Shia faction is still blowing things up. I mean, this is the problem, you know, throughout the Arab world, which at least the Arabs are talking about now. But now in Libya, they might get a chance. They'll have a chance to do something about it. The question is, will they?
I think they will. I think that's being, you know, enough is coming out I'm talking about in terms of what I've seen in predominantly in foreign media. I mentioned BBC, but that's not the only place. There was a Al Jazeera, Jim, put together. Now this was, oh goodness, I think this is early April. So we're talking almost three months ago, an excellent short mini documentary that I saw on the web. One of their correspondents was in there with the Berbers, and they back in that the Snafusa Mountains. That was what I was trying to think of a second ago. That Snafusa Escarpment is really what it is, where a lot of these fights are going on between Gaddafi's merc forces and the Berbers. And I was impressed with some of the comments made by some of the Berber fighters that were interviewed. They're very aware of the information dimension, media dimension, but information dimension of that is in play in the world right now, and it is a window for them to use politically.
Yeah,
they got to fight. They are fighting, but they also have played this impressed me was that they were aware of this and how they were going to use this as a political opportunity. So, Google for the Al Jazeera report on the Berbers. This is not going to be explicitly addressed in it, but you know, pay attention to what the report said. It was a really good Al Jazeera report. So,
well, Al Jazeera is right in the middle of this Arab Renaissance business, you know, on the Gulf states, you know, Dubai and what have you. And indeed, that's where a lot of the Arab support for the Libyan rebels is coming from, including, according to the French, some of the weapons they dropped. Some of the weapons, and they said this outright, that some of the weapons they were supplied by Arab Gulf countries. And apparently the Arab Gulf countries, you know, aren't upset with, you know, being mentioned that way. So, you know, that's where the Arab Reformation may come from.
Well, the two countries, Jim, correct me on this if I'm wrong, the two countries I've seen mentioned in this, or at least in speculation, coming out of UAE and Qatar, is that what you hear from
some of the Gulf states, yeah. Yeah.
Well, those two in particular, but that's...
Exactly. Now, Doha is what they keep talking about. Doha, Doha, Doha. That's the font of the resistance. Lord knows what's going to happen with that, but we can be optimistic.
Now, one thing that's a question is how the NATO effort is going to hang together. You've got Italy now waffling on whether they support the effort. You've got France going gung-ho. You've got American politics starting to play into it.
what's going to continue there with the NATO effort?
Well, from what I hear, it's mainly Britain and France that are doing most of the, you know, the bombing, as it were. And Britain, France, and the United States that are doing most of the intel work. The United States apparently still does occasional bombing. And if, you know, if Obama doesn't get shut down, you know, by the Congress, we could probably do more bombing. But we're doing most of the intel work with the help of France and Britain, who also have intelligence gathering assets over there. That's where apparently the Afghan, you know, tactics are coming from. You know, it's not any big secret. It's been written about them in books written about it, what have you. We've shared the technical aspects of it with our NATO allies. The French and the British obviously have used it in Afghanistan. But that 2-month campaign in late 2001, you know, is basically the tactical roadmap for what they're doing in Libya. They're not coming right out and saying it, but you know, some Austin and I can just look at that and say, "Hey, I see what's happening there. That looks familiar." And all the information I'm getting is that they're putting people on the ground. One guy was telling me, this is second or third hand. He said it was first hand, but that the Westerners, the Europeans, whatever, or the Americans in one case, on the ground speak Arabic, and some of them are saying they're Turkish. Now that's an interesting angle. I doubt if the Turks have somebody there, but they might. Turks apparently have a distinctive Arabic accent. The fact of the matter is that NATO is doing a lot more than they're taking credit for. So it was surprising that the French came out and admitted that they were dropping weapons, although I suspect that they realized this was going to come out pretty soon, so it's probably better just to come right out and say it. You know, 50 tons is a lot of airdrops. And the basic, I think this has something to do with headbutting with the UN, getting the UN to basically give some consent to this so other people can contribute. Maybe it's just a ploy to get the United States, because we have a lot fancier parachutes and more assets, you know, to dump stuff there. Indeed, some of the airdrops may have been American for all we know. But NATO does have a strategy, and what they're saying now publicly is that in 90 days, it's going to be over. Now, it's been 100 days now, and looking at it professionally, as it were, given the pounding that Gaddafi's people are taking, you know, they dropped thousands of smart bombs. It's over 100 a day. And we know from past experience, like in Afghanistan, you know, in the after-action surveys done in Afghanistan, we reported this in Strategy Page. We did terrible damage, you know, to the Taliban. I mean, really tore them apart. And that's what Gaddafi's getting now. I think the only problem we have is that the Afghans had been fighting, you know, the Taliban for years. So while they were untrained, they were experienced. Most of the people on the ground in Libya, at best, you know, were veterans of the Libyan army, which is nothing to be really proud of. But they had, you know, at least they knew how to use a rifle, clean it, and what have you. But most of them are just literally civilians, getting a hold of a weapon, learning how to, you know, load it and fire it, and hopefully how to clean it. And going out there and fighting with the Libyan army. There's Libyan volunteers. Gaddafi's talked about having given 1.2 million weapons out to his supporters. And as Austin pointed out, not all of them turned out to be his supporters. We did do some reporting on what was going on in Tripoli. And there have been examples of armed, actions against, you know, Gaddafi forces. And indeed, I think NATO admitted that they were getting tweeted information. They had set up, well, I deduced this, that they deduced a way to analyze the tweets coming out of Tripoli and figuring out who's on their side and who's accurate and who's not. And using this as part of their database for targeting purposes. And apparently it's been very successful, because look at it. There's been very few civilian casualties in Tripoli. And this is what Gaddafi is running around looking for. And apparently he's created some, you know, stage. And the reporters in there, guys who had been around, they said, oh, wait a minute, I've seen this before. And Gaddafi didn't realize that, so he was brought up short on his attempts to stage manage atrocities. A bomb going wrong is not an atrocity technically, but depending on whose publicist is handling it. But the fact of the matter is that he has not got the forces that can take this much punishment forever. He's isolated. He's getting no air, nothing coming in by air, nothing coming in by sea. They're only allowing food and medicine. There's no ammunition. Now, he's got a lot of ammunition, but he's also got a lot of people getting banged up pretty bad. And there's already been reports of more of his people surrendering or just basically disappearing, possibly even some of his mercenaries, no matter how much well they're paid. And we reported, months ago that he's got cash on hand, but not enough apparently to keep these mercenaries, fighting indefinitely. And if the mercenaries are taking a big beating, these guys come up in batches. So if one batch of 100 or so guys realize that half of them are dead, they're going to say, "Well, I'm going to take what I've made so far and go home while I still can." So he's got serious morale problems, and they're only going to get worse. There's no upside for Gaddafi. Now that he's been indicted by the International Criminal Court, he's having a much harder time getting, out of the country and taking up residence somewhere else. I think his only alternatives now are Venezuela and North Korea. What a choice. And there's still the transportation problem. So he's stuck.
I'm sorry, Jim, there is one option that's been laid out there that I've noticed that NATO has not contradicted yet. Turkey, about 3 weeks ago, maybe around 1st of June, somewhere between the 1st and 7th of June, my recollection. One of the Turkish foreign ministers, and I think the president of Turkey later picked this up and mentioned it as well, was that Turkey would guarantee his safety. Didn't say he was going to exile him in Turkey if he left Libya.
Yeah, so I could see the Turks flying in a clearly marked Turkish aircraft, which would then fly to North Korea.
Or wherever, exactly. That's probably, but you see, look, the thing is that there are a lot of ways to read that.
Yeah.
Let me give you the Occam's razor.
Yeah, but the ICC has complicated it.
Sure. Well, the thing is, it's Turkey's a NATO member, and Turkey's been talking with that group that France organized about how to handle the economic components of this. You said there's some evidence that maybe the Turks have been more directly involved because there's a lot that's not being talked about. But when that kind of statement is made at the official level, that happens. It was a high official, the high officials, foreign ministry, and then I think it was the president of Turkey picked it up. That most likely, it's possible it's freelance shot always, but most likely that's been coordinated with your allies and said, all right, despite what is said on this, we will guarantee, and here's Turkey saying, we're a predominantly Muslim nation, we're going to guarantee you, Gaddafi, security, safe access, safe egress is really what it would amount to if you quit Tripoli. So here he's under all this pressure, and then you've got this major regional power saying, we'll give you a magic carpet. So that's still in play despite the International Criminal Court allegations, or maybe it's the indictment, arrest warrants, and the like, and trying to bomb him out in Tripoli. It may look better and better, and to Gaddafi to take that flight to Pyongyang.
The Turks could put on their Muslim
an option too.
The Turks could put on their Muslim hat and say, "Hey, I know we're members of NATO and all that, but we have to do this for a fellow Muslim to save lives."
The political, sure. I mean,
exactly.
That's why,
and they could get away with that.
Turkey doing it, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like it gives them some sort of a political out. But Mike, again, I could have been freelance, but you take a look at the way it worked. I think it's part of the diplomatic action to coordinate with the military action.
Yeah.
One thing, let me pick up, Jim. I have not read or heard of any armed action inside Tripoli. I don't know whether that's what you, you know.
Well, it showed up. This has made it out into the, I forget where I picked it up, but I got confirmation of it. There has been a lot of action within Tripoli of the Libyan secret police, you know, looking for traitors, as it were.
I did read that. Okay, I knew.
But apparently, a large chunk of the population, even those who used to be, you know, his, you know, fans, as it were, Gaddafi's fans, are now disaffected because they're cut off.
Well, that's
some of them apparently. A lot of them apparently aren't. They don't see any future. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're not gonna keep waving, you know, Gaddafi's flag. No, you're gonna try and do something that'll ingratiate yourself with the new bosses. Get your old civil service job back.
Right.
Well, Dan, I think we could say that the colonel is under a lot of pressure.
Under a lot of pressure. We'll have to check back in probably about 90 days and see if he's still there.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. We'll talk to you next time, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys. Bye.